Well, welcome to this last in our present lecture series on the theme of identity. Thus far, we've dealt with the many-layered identity of portraiture and of music and of literature, and the elusive nature of identity to lawyers, the omnipresence of identity to mathematicians, and we've dealt with the question of identity of ourselves as people. And then last week, we learnt what a huge amount of resources the body devotes to preserving its own identity in terms of dispelling diseases. Well, very fittingly, for the last in the series, our subject this evening is species identity. Why do we have identity as a species? Why does any species have identity, for that matter? And we're very fortunate to have Sir Peter Crane as our speaker. Sir Peter's currently a professor at the University of Chicago. He comes from Kettering and went to for his first and subsequent degree at Reading University before going to the States, moving to Chicago and ending up as the director of their field museum. And then in 1999, he came over to the huge job of being director of the Botanic Garden at Kew Gardens, where he created a wonderful impression by the energy he gave to scientific work on conservation and diversity. We couldn't have a better speaker to end the series and to talk about species identity. Sir Peter.
Thank you, Master, very much. It's a great pleasure to be here and to have this opportunity to address you on the topic of species identity. Let's see if this works. There we go. It's encouraging. May the 23rd of this year will see worldwide celebrations of the tercentenary of the birth of the Swedish physician and naturalist Carl Linnaeus. Born the son of a clergyman in relatively humble surroundings in Småland, southern Sweden, Linnaeus had a remarkable life that established him as one of the great intellectuals of the 18th century. Today, Linnaeus is almost a heroic figure, especially in Sweden, where his life is celebrated and his face appears on the 100 krona banknote. And his image has been captured by hundreds of paintings and statues around the world. He's widely recognized as one of the great figures in the history of science. He combined great industry with extraordinary talent. He was an accomplished writer and poet. He was an inspiring teacher. He made important contributions to medicine, and he modified the temperature scale developed by Celsius into the one that we use today. And this is your speaker with a statue of Linnaeus at the University of Chicago, and the temperature that morning was minus 15 degrees Celsius. Quite clearly, Linnaeus was also a dominating presence, both at Uppsala University and elsewhere. For example, he helped found the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences in 1739 and served as its first president. But his real passion was the diversity of life, and he was the first to try and get to grips with it in a comprehensive and scientific way. Many others before him, building on the folk taxonomies of Europe, had sought to name recognizable entities in the living world. But it was Linnaeus who established the essentials of the approach that we still use today, with the identity of species at its core. Linnaeus succeeded, and in a remarkable way, at least if success is measured by the extent to which his approach has been widely adopted. Linnaeus's work was adopted not because of some dazzling new theoretical insight, but mainly because it was pragmatic, systematically applied, and near comprehensive. And as a result, it was exceedingly useful. Today, despite many subsequent advances in the life sciences, species still remain the basic currency in our understanding of biological diversity. And the idea of species has become entwined in our lives and also in our laws in diverse and complicated ways. When Linnaeus gave specimens of the common cultivated hemp the name Cannabis sativa, he could scarcely have imagined that 200 years later there would be a lively debate in American courts over whether his name was, quote, sufficiently comprehensive to prescribe all kinds of marijuana. The dispute over the plant that has been cultivated for millennia as a source of fiber and oil, as well as the production of hashish, brings into sharp focus some of the problems inherent in establishing species identity. Is there just a single species of cannabis, or are there more? What about the plants named Cannabis ruderalis and Cannabis indica? How do we decide? Only Cannabis sativa is mentioned in the US legislation. Does this mean that the other species are legal? The fact that during the 1970s, different botanical authorities lined up on both sides of the one species versus multiple species of cannabis argument, and one, my old friend Dick Schultes, even managed to change sides, suggests that there's scope for different interpretations of the same situation in nature. And if that is the case, what can we conclude about the reality of species, especially those that are much less well known than the species that you see behind me on the screen? In this paper, I'll outline some of the complexity associated with current ideas of species identity, focusing particularly on plants. Much has been written on the species concept in biology, especially from the standpoint of theory. It would be fruitless here to attempt a detailed review. I suspect you might also find it rather tedious. So what I'll do instead is to touch on both the theoretical and practical issues, especially as they relate to species identity in plants and the use of species as the fundamental units in the scientific study of plant diversity. Linnaeus is best known for developing a pragmatic approach to naming species using a Latin binomial that includes a generic name, such as cannabis, combined with a specific epithet, Cannabis sativa. However, Linnaean binomials had been in use, for example, by Caspar Bauhin well before Linnaeus. Bauhin and others had also organized biological diversity hierarchically, but it was Linnaeus who established this approach as standard through its relentless application across the whole of biology. And because the binomials proved more useful than the cumbersome polynomials that Linnaeus also used, they were quickly taken up. Linnaeus's great contribution was much more than just popularizing an elegant way of labeling species and coming up with memorable names. It was more to do with his energy, his industry, and his scholarship in applying a consistent approach to a near comprehensive systematization of biological diversity as it was known at that time. Linnaeus was also acquisitive. He was interested in the work being done by others and incorporated plants and animals encountered by his contemporaries in his own treatments. Many of his generic names were also taken from the work of earlier authors. His concept of Cannabis sativa, which you see down at the bottom of this page, for example, uses the genus name, the word used much earlier by Bauhin, Dalechamp, and others. And Linnaeus's concept of the plant was based in large part not only on specimens in his own collections, but on material he saw in the private collections of the wealthy Anglo-Dutch merchant and financier George Clifford. Linnaeus described many new species from the living and dried specimens in Clifford's collections during his time in the Netherlands between 1735 and 1737. These are the specimens of cannabis that Linnaeus very likely saw in Clifford's herbarium and that served as the basis in part for his name. And they still exist among the specimens in the Clifford herbarium that was purchased subsequently by Sir Joseph Banks in 1791 and that is now preserved in the collections of the Botany Department of the Natural History Museum. But Linnaeus was also cautious. In Systema Naturae, he included a class Paradoxa, in which he placed many organisms about which he was uncertain. With the benefit of hindsight, we now see that some of these, like the satyr, were clearly imaginary. Others were real, but Linnaeus had cause to be uncertain about them. For example, at first he placed the pelican in the paradoxa because he considered it such an implausible animal. Only later did he feel comfortable actually including it as a bird. Linnaeus was also anxious to gather information on new material brought back by collectors from far-flung parts of the world. His widely traveled students, such as Per Kalm, Frederick Hasselquist, Daniel Solander, Karl-Peter Thunberg, were one important source of material. but he also continually expanded the scope of his work through his own travels to Lapland and elsewhere in Scandinavia, through exchange of specimens, and through extensive correspondence. And through a quirk of history, in part associated with a decline in Linnaeus's reputation at home in the late 18th century, the bulk of his specimens, including 14,000 plants, as well as the associated animals, library, and correspondence, were purchased by James Smith in 1783, and they comprise the core of the collections of the Linnaean Society of London that was founded in 1788. So when you walk past Burlington House, Linnaeus's collections are right there in the basement of the Linnaean Society. Linnaeus was also methodical and scholarly in his approach, which was fundamentally comparative and empirical. Wherever possible, he based his ideas on data in the form of reference specimens, previous literature, and illustrations, all of which he examined critically in reaching his conclusions. He also set out 38 principles, in effect a research method, outlining how work in natural history should be done. These principles included many practices that are now standard in the study of biological diversity. For example, the importance of listing synonyms, providing information on habitats, and giving precise locality details. But they also go further to enumerate principles of more general value in science, such as the importance of comparative methods and complete, careful descriptions. And these principles also make it clear that Linnaeus was interested not just in describing and naming, but that he was also driven by the urge to systematize information. In his view, a proper account of species should synthesize all that's known about it, from its form and structure to its ecology and use. Linnaeus's other key contribution was to bring order out of chaos in the naming of plants and animals. Through his energy and scholarship, as well as the global sweep of his work, he effectively drew a line under an important source of confusion created by his predecessors, the use of multiple names for the same species. Others had recognized the plant that Linnaeus called Cannabis sativa before he gave it that name in 1753. He himself had called it Cannabis foliis digitatis in Hortus Cliffortianus, while Dalachamp had used the names Cannabis mass and Cannabis femina. But in his time, Linnaeus set a new baseline. And it's for this reason, as much as anything to do with the details of his approach, that Species Plantarum of Linnaeus 1753 is taken as the historical starting point for the scientific naming of plants under the International Code of Botanical Nomenclature. It is also clear that for Linnaeus, the species had special meaning. At one level, species were merely another category in the extended hierarchy of classes, orders, and genera. But Linnaeus also viewed species as real units in nature, waiting to be discovered. Linnaeus's famous aphorism, "God creates, Linnaeus orders," that was his aphorism, not only gives a sense of the way he viewed his own prominence in understanding the variety of life, but at another level, it was a position of conscious humility. He saw himself as merely discovering the order in God's creation. And a necessary corollary of this worldview was that species were fixed and unchanging. Species are as many as were created in the beginning by the infinite. There are many who helped clear the way for Darwin and Wallace, but among them, Linnaeus was one of the more important. Through his work and through its widespread adoption as the basis for organizing biological diversity, he formalized the idea of species as the basic unit in biology, and in ordering them within a hierarchy, he showed that there was also a higher structure in nature. Both of these ideas were essential in the subsequent development of an evolutionary view of species. Linnaeus's view of everyone's war against everyone, included in his Politia Naturae of 1760, which Darwin read before Malthus, also recalls Darwin's views on the struggle for existence. Similarly, his perspective on the economy of nature was important in the subsequent development of ecology. Darwin had a pragmatic view of species. but his work fundamentally changed the way in which species were viewed, most notably by altering the perception of them as fixed and unchanging entities. However, Darwin offered no new practical methods by which species could be delimited. Indeed, he minimized the significance of species, seeing them as part of a continuum from orders and families and genera above the species level to subspecies and varieties below. And as many have commented, Darwin's impact on the actual practice of systematics, as contrasted with the interpretation of its results, was relatively minimal. Darwin was interested in how species came about, but he could not have set out his view of what they represented more clearly. I look at the term species as one arbitrarily given for the sake of convenience to a set of individuals closely resembling each other. It was only with the development of genetics 50 years later, followed by the so-called modern synthesis of Huxley between 1920 and 1950, that a new view of species began to emerge. The bringing together of systematics, genetics, and paleontology into a new holistic view of evolution cast species in a new light and brought into focus the two related issues of how species change and how they maintain their integrity. The result was the biological species concept, most frequently linked with the name of the ornithologist Ernst Mayr. Mayr defined species as groups of actually or potentially interbreeding natural populations, isolated from other such groups by reproductive barriers. This defined species by actual or potential internal continuity of gene flow, as well as by barriers to gene flow that exist with other species. It proved hugely influential, especially for concepts of species identity among birds and other land vertebrates. And it's also been applied to plants, and it was decisive, at least in the mind of Small and Cronquist, for example, in the cannabis controversy. And I quote from their work, "Aside from some experimentally produced polyploids, all cannabis is diploid, and there appears to be no barrier to successful hybridization within the genus." They came up with a single species of cannabis within which they treated two particular groups as two subspecies, subspecies sativa, subspecies indica, indica being the one with the intoxicant potentials, sativa being the one more useful for its fibers. So does this mean that the two species, the English bluebell and the Spanish bluebell, which successfully form hybrids if they're brought together, should be merged into a single species? Nevertheless, the biological species concept has had many, many critics. One problem has been a certain circularity in terms of cause and effect. Even in the absence of evidence, reproductive isolation has often been inferred to be the cause of morphological distinctiveness, while morphological distinctiveness has been seen as an effect of barriers to reproduction. There are many examples where it is now known that morphological similarity can be maintained even in the absence of ongoing interbreeding. There are also examples, when selection is especially ruthless, of distinctiveness being maintained despite ongoing interbreeding. Another problem has been confusion between the criteria used to recognize the species as a group and the basis for assigning that group to a rank in the classificatory hierarchy. The biological species concept fails to distinguish between these two elements. In effect, it does both at the same time. And one group of modern criticisms asserts that it's insufficiently concerned with the criteria of grouping, and that the question of ranking, in any case, has meaning only in terms of genealogical relationships. The problems of grouping and ranking come to the fore again in the most recent study of cannabis that I could find, anyway, from 2005, which looked at allozyme variation in 17 gene loci for 157 diverse cannabis accessions, and that ended up with two major groups and with a thinner scatter of intermediate and outlying points. This author adopted for a concept of cannabis with three species, cannabis sativa, cannabis indica, and cannabis ruderalis. Over the last 50 years, much has been written on the strengths and weaknesses of the biological species concept, and many other kinds of species concepts have been developed. The cohesion species concept, the ecological species concept, the evolutionary species concept, and at least two different formulations of the phylogenetic species concept, and there are many others in the literature. Given the importance of species identity in biology and in society, such introspection and debate is to be expected, but I would argue it's had little practical impact on understanding the bulk of plant diversity. And this is largely a problem of scale and unevenness in knowledge about plant species. In the 10th edition of Systema Naturae, Linnaeus enumerated a little over 17,000 animal and plant species. Modern estimates of the total number of living species of all kinds, excluding bacteria and their allies, place that number as somewhere between 5 and 10 million, of which only about 1.5 million have been described so far. In his lifetime, Linnaeus recognized about 9,000 species of plants. He thought that the total number might be about 10,000. We now know that the total number of described plant species is more likely to be in the range 350,000 to 400,000. Given the daunting practicalities of applying more sophisticated techniques to such a vast number of species, most plant species are defined today in much the same way as Linnaeus and other naturalists of the 18th and 19th centuries. Despite current knowledge of how species develop through the process of evolution, despite ever deeper insights gained from genetics, despite advances in the theory of systematics, and despite the increasingly sophisticated tools now available to us, it's not yet practical to apply them all to the vast and poorly sampled variety of plant life. And the numbers for plants are very large. This just compares the number of flowering plant species with the number of species of vertebrates. And you see quite quickly why so much of our practical work in conservation is based on birds and mammals rather than on plants. We hope they're telling us the same story that other organisms would tell us if we knew them as well. Plants, like most other groups of non-microscopic organisms, show a characteristic relationship between the number of species and the extent of their distribution. This graph is for several tens of thousands of flowering plant species. There are very few widespread species. Most plant species are relatively restricted in their geographic distribution. And it's also the case for plants, as for other major groups of organisms, that the greatest concentration of species is in the tropics. And as a result, many of these very restricted distributions are found in the tropics, and those areas of the tropics that are very poorly known, very poorly sampled, very poorly understood. For example, here in the UK, we have a relatively depauperate flora, perhaps 1,400 native plant species. The flora has been intensively studied and is relatively well known. Some species, like the lady's slipper orchid, we know the exact distribution of the very small number of individuals as they occur in the wild. Many plant species have been the subject of detailed treatments in the biological flora accounts of the British Ecological Society. Some have been studied from the standpoint of gene flow and breeding systems at a level that provides deeper understanding of the processes by which species integrity and species differences are maintained. But the contrast with the flora of Madagascar is worth looking at. The Madagascan flora is very much larger, also has a much larger proportion of endemic species. It's hard to find data on the species of most conservation concern. There's very little population or ecological data available, and we're finding new species all the time. At Kew, we've done some detailed work on various subgroups of the Madagascar flora, and I think it's quite interesting to just look at the results of what came out of those studies. And if you look at the orchids, the palms, and the legumes of Madagascar, all of which have been treated relatively recently between 1995 and today by particular treatments at Kew, you see that they're producing a vast number of newly described species. So orchids, 103 new species. Palms, 70 new species. Legumes, 129 new species. It's obvious that our knowledge of the botanical inventory of the tropics is really very scanty. At Kew, we'd been keeping statistics on the number of new plant species described through time, and just to give you a sense, it's around 2,000 new species of plants every year. And where do they come from? Well, in general, they tend to come from places where there's a coincidence of factors, where there's high species diversity and also a lot of effort going into the recognition of new species. So China and Australia that are getting to grips with their flora relatively well, Brazil, which has a growing cadre of plant systematic biologists, and places like Ecuador, Colombia, and so on, which are the focus of studies by overseas scientists. I'm sure that Madagascar and Borneo and the like would be much higher up the table if they received an equivalent amount of attention. And it's also very clear that through time, if you look at the geographic range of these new species, in general, the species that we're finding today through time are increasingly those of very, very narrow distribution. So I'll only mention one example here, but it's an entertaining case study. This is Wollemia nobilis, the so-called Wollemi pine. It was discovered in 1994, not in a continent that hasn't been explored for some time. It was found in Australia, and it was found less than 100 kilometres from the centre of Sydney. It was a new genus in a family that only has two genera, the monkey puzzle family. And it occurs just in one very isolated canyon, and that's why it had been overlooked. It consists in total of about 150 individual specimens. So it's a classic case of one of these newly described species, very restricted in distribution, and also as a result, therefore, very vulnerable to the simple bad luck, which could take it over to the edge of extinction. I just digress for a moment on the Wollemia story because I think it's been treated in a very interesting way by the Australians. Having come across this thing, they then decided, first of all, to not let people go and see it, which I think was a very smart move, so that it wasn't subjected to a new wave of pathogens being brought in by people's boots and so on. But then they also decided that they would commercialize it and plow those profits from the commercialization of that species back into the conservation of the wild species. So just a couple of years ago, and by the way, its great interest is that it's very similar to fossils that are about 150 million years old from Australia, so it's one of these living fossil-type discoveries. But the result was, a couple of years ago, that these plants were then introduced into cultivation, so you can buy a Wollemia now if you'd like to have one in your garden, and here it is being planted at Kew by Sir David Attenborough. And very smartly, they auctioned the first generation of Wollemi pines through Sotheby's and created quite a bit of cash, which they were then able to plough back into the conservation of the wild population. But back to our topic. Our relatively poor knowledge of plant species, especially in the tropics, is not only indicated by the frequent discovery of new species, but also by the relative paucity of information about them that's available. One simple measure is provided by the number of herbarium specimens that are available for study. Most native British species have been collected extensively and are very well represented in many herbarium collections. For Madagascar, the majority of specimens are held in herbaria in Madagascar itself, in the capital, Antananarivo, in herbaria at the Missouri Botanical Garden, at the Paris Natural History Museum, and also at the Royal Botanic Gardens, Kew. Taking legumes as an example, about half of the 435 species recognized so far in Madagascar are represented in these combined collections by less than 10 specimens. And if you look at where the legumes of Madagascar are coming from in a geographical situation, you see some interesting wiggly lines. Well, those are the roads. And when you can pick out the roads as the major locus of your sampling effort, then you realize that there are large areas of Madagascar which have not been properly surveyed for its plant diversity. Under these circumstances, and especially because plant species diversity is broadly concentrated in those parts of the world where human and institutional biodiversity capacity is not well developed, it's not surprising that most plant species are recognized using an approach that's fundamentally little different from that of Linnaeus. And what's true for plants is also true for other groups of organisms that make up the bulk of global biodiversity. Outside the most conspicuous groups of animals and their most common representatives, the variety of life is vast, poorly sampled, and very imperfectly understood. And that prevents us from doing many of the things that we would like to do with species. For example, assessing their conservation status through time, as is done by IUCN on the basis of certain animal groups. And also, for example, for modeling the likely changing distributions of plants with global climate change. We don't have a series of maps that would overlay, that we could overlay to show the distribution of species and therefore start to model how they might respond to changing climates. So does all this mean that most plant species are merely arbitrary constructs of the human mind? Or do they in some way approximate fundamental units in nature that have some meaningful evolutionary reality? It's a difficult question to answer, but different approaches suggest that most of the plant species that we recognize by traditional means are indeed biologically meaningful. One crude indication, for example, is provided by considering the fate at the subsequent hands of subsequent systematists of the 9,000 or so plant species recognized by Linnaeus. This sample of plant diversity includes the most common plants of Europe, as well as some of the most common plants from other parts of the world, many of which have been studied in some detail. What is interesting is that while many species have been reassigned to different genera, a topic that I'll come back to in a moment, and some have been subdivided more finely, relatively few have been synonymized. In other words, at least in terms of recognizing basic units of plant diversity, getting a handle on the species identity for the plant kingdom as a whole, Linnaeus basically got it right, at least as far as he was able to go. His species concepts, very broadly, have stood the test of time. The same picture emerges if one compares treatments of plants from the same area done by different authors from different research groups with different backgrounds. 8 or 9 times out of 10, they come up with the same species. Edgar Anderson was the first to point this out in the mid-1950s. Ernst Mayr actually did publish a botanical paper, and he analyzed the species of vascular plants from Concord Township in eastern Massachusetts that were so much admired by Henry Thoreau. He concluded, and I quote, "The vast majority, to be exact, 616 of the 838 named species of Concord Township are so well defined that they raise no problems of species identity." Similarly, in a study of 104 monographs that treated over 1,700 plant species, about 80% of them were described without any indication that they posed a particular problem. So the picture that begins to emerge is that most plant species seem to have an identity that can be recognized in a repeatable way. The well-known so-called difficult groups of plants that result from unusual reproductive such situations, such as apomixis or hybridization, are very much in the minority. A more detailed study of the nature of plant species, but based on a more restricted sample, was undertaken by Lauren Riesberg and his colleagues, who compared the correspondence between plant species delimited by traditional means and within genus morphological clusters recognized by quantitative methods. They found that only about half of the clusters for both plants and animals corresponded to traditionally recognized plant species. Most of the difference was accounted for by over-differentiation, recognition of more than one species per cluster by traditional methods. A further analysis based on a review of crossing data for species within 114 plant genera indicated that about 70% of these traditionally recognized plant species were likely to reflect reproductively independent lineages. While these results are comparatively crude, for example, in considering only post-mating rather than pre-mating isolation, they do suggest that traditionally recognized species are not entirely arbitrary. The other side of the coin, however, remains. Is there sufficient gene flow among the plant populations of a single species to unite them as a single evolutionary unit? In many cases, and it's been clear now for some time, the answer to that question is clearly no. And this highlights a further problem with the biological species concept. It's a description of an idealized situation in the here and now that takes no account of history. The individual populations may have been united by gene flow in the past, during the crucial phase of their morphological differentiation, but this may no longer be the case. In the same way, the capacity to interbreed might provide a poor indication of genealogical relationship. If some subgroup of an evolutionary lineage, for example, becomes reproductively isolated, it would be quite possible to have some members of the leftover group that still has reproductive continuity actually being more closely related to the subgroup that's now reproductively isolated. In other words, with the group with which they cannot breed. And these are the kinds of arguments that have led some to propose an evolutionary or phylogenetic species concept that takes more account of history and common ancestry. So are plant species equal? While knowledge of individual plant species is very uneven, and while the different situations that they represent in terms of genetic and population level processes are uncertain, they're clearly not all equal. They're still treated operationally as being equal. They're treated as fundamental units that have some basic equivalence. They're used, for example, by simply counting up the numbers of species, counting up the number of endemic species, and used as an overall index of biological diversity, in this case in space, in order to decide upon conservation priorities. This is the Norman Myers map of his so-called biodiversity hotspots, arrived at by counting up the total number of plant species and the total number of endemic plant species in large part. It's also interesting, however, that conservation biologists, by the same token, have come quickly to the conclusion that not all species are identical in terms of their importance for conservation. At its simplest, this idea emphasizes that in terms of conservation, Ginkgo biloba, as the sole living representative of an ancient and once more diverse group of plants, is relatively more important than, for example, one of the 300 species of the neotropical legume genus Inga, all of which are very closely related and all of which appear to have arisen relatively recently. This idea has been formalized and quantified in a series of papers in which the phylogenetic distinctiveness of species is factored into the development of conservation priorities. And it's interesting that priorities based on pure species richness are not always the same as priorities based on phylogenetic distinctiveness. This is the Cape of Good Hope, and these data are from a recent paper in Science by Felix Forrest and his colleagues, which also included co-authors here at Cambridge, which compared simple diversity measures with phylogenetic diversity across the Cape. Simple diversity would highlight the floras of the Western Cape, looking also factoring in the elements of phylogenetic distinctiveness, focuses more on the Western Cape. The central problem at the core of biodiversity science, which is reflected in different concepts of species identity, is the inherent conflict between the scientific objectives of this science, discovering the fundamental units of biological diversity, understanding the processes that give rise to these units, resolving phylogenetic relationships, all that on the one hand, versus what's clearly a service function that systematics provides to the rest of science and society in terms of providing a stable and reliable system for purposes of unambiguous communication. In an ideal world, we'd simply discover the basic units of biological diversity and give them names. But unfortunately, studies of plant diversity are rarely so clear-cut. What we have instead, as in other areas of science, is successive approximations to the truth. It's in the nature of the way that science works, but it's nevertheless a reality that does not engender stability. There are two main problems with regard to nomenclatural stability, what one might call the curse of synonymy and the inconsistent use of names. With regard to synonymy, Linnaeus's work was a breakthrough. But since then, systematists have struggled to preserve the order that he was able to create. So what you see here is Linnaeus's Species Plantarum account of cannabis, and Cannabis sativa was taken as the name. What you see below is just a few of the many other species of cannabis that have been named subsequent to Linnaeus. And sifting through all of these is a huge problem in getting to grips with plant diversity. So with regard to synonymy, Linnaeus' work was a breakthrough because he drew a line under what had come before, but we've had trouble keeping things as neat and tidy ever since. Given the much larger of number of species that we now know to exist, very much larger than Linnaeus ever imagined, and given the distributed and fundamentally entrepreneurial enterprise of science, it's inevitable that different scientists come to give the same biological entity different names. And while the principle of priority establishes which of these names should be used, given certain rules of nomenclature, it still has to be applied, and there's no central register, so it's often difficult to track down the correct name for a particular species. And for plants, the scale of this problem is considerable. The International Plant Names Index, maintained by Kew, the Harvard University Herbarium, and the Australian National Herbarium, contains almost a million names. Differences in the estimates of the total number of angiosperm species basically reduce to figuring out the level of synonymy in that nearly 1 million name list. It's also unfortunate that the matter of synonymy cannot be solved simply by the application of nomenclatural rules. Unfortunately, it's a matter of scientific judgment because of an unfortunate weakness inherent in Linnaeus's binomial system. Uniform application of the binomial approach requires uniform concepts of both genus and species identity. The binomial system, rather unfortunately, intertwines the delivery of straightforward species labels with the very much more complicated issue of how similarities and differences translate into hypotheses of evolutionary relatedness at the generic level. So when generic concepts change, so too can the Latin binomials. For example, the recent discovery of a new kind of conifer in Vietnam led to its description by a Kew scientist as Xanthociparus vietnamensis. This is the species being held in his hand here. This, in turn, led to a reassignment of the Canadian Nootka cypress, Camiciparus nootkatensis, to the new genus as Xanthociparus nootkatensis. To a Canadian forester, this would be bad enough, but the knock-on effects go further. Because Xanthociparus nootkatensis is one of the parents of the commonly grown Leyland cypress, its name too has to change from Cupressa cypress leylandi to Cupro cyparis leylandii. So now it's the gardener and those who seek to control the planting of this outsized conifer in suburbia who are upset. and the situation will get worse if Chamaecyparis nootkayensis is reassigned to Calotropis, as is suggested by a recent study using DNA-based estimates of its phylogenetic position. Beyond synonymy, a further problem has been the inconsistent use of the same name for different things. This issue has been solved by the designation of type specimens. Specimens, this was in the early 20th century, in an attempt to get some stability around this, specimens to which a particular name is forever attached within the framework of rules developed by the International Code of Botanical Nomenclature. A bit like the principle of priority, its rigorous application can be time-consuming. To give you just one example, Linnaeus didn't designate type specimens for the species that he recognized. And it's taken a considerable effort, indeed most of the career of one of my friends, through a long-term joint project by the Natural History Museum, supported by the Linnaean Society, to sift through all the evidence that Linnaeus considered for all the plant species he described, and therefore, in most cases, to be able to designate a type specimen. So while the systems and processes in the International Code of Botanical Nomenclature can help systematics towards its goal of stable and useful names, it does not trump systematic judgment, and its rules can also be laborious to apply. And these rules are only open to change every 6 years by a vote at the general session of the International Association for Plant Taxonomy. Change, to keep pace with other rapid change in the world, is not easy for such a body to embrace. Radical change is anathema. The result is frustration, so much so that some consider the rules to be as much part of the problem as part of the solution in urgent attempts to increase the speed and utility of the systems we use to cope with the vast diversity in many groups of organisms. In addition to stable and useful systems of names, another important function provided by systematics is aids to species identification. Linnaeus, in his overtly artificial sexual system by which he organized his classes, provided a means of getting into his classification, a means of beginning the identification. He also, in a way, through his diagnoses, used the dichotomous key. And the dichotomous key has been the tool of choice for identifying plant species and other species. The problem with them is that their telegraphic brevity, as well as their reliance on technical terminology, makes them difficult for the non-specialist to master. Now, we have multi-access electronic keys becoming increasingly available over the web, supplemented by illustrations and images that you can enter at any point and follow any path through these identification guides. And these provide a much more effective way of identifying unknown plants. At different levels and in many different circumstances, the repeatable identification of plant species is crucial to all kinds of things in our lives, not only legislation regarding drug species, but also legislation, for example, international legislation regarding the exchange of plant genetic resources, or, for example, the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species. More than 25,000 species are controlled under CITES. And each year, Kew, as the UK scientific authority for plants, processed more than about 5,000 applications for plant CITES licenses. And at a national level, individual species may be protected by federal or national legislation, such as the Endangered Species Act in the UK. In addition to its importance for environmental and conservation management, the accurate identification of plants for medicinal purposes was a primary stimulus for the development of early scientific interest in plants. Much of the effort that went into the descriptions and illustrations of the early herbalists was directed toward plant identification. This is the Padua Botanic Garden from 1545, created as a medicinal garden in association with that university. And still today, more than 80% of the global population, mainly in the developing world, turns to plants as their primary source of medicines, and in these circumstances, correct plant identification is obviously a priority. Closer to home, accurate identification is still very much an issue in drug safety, as attempts continue to properly integrate scientific Latin binomials with widely used pharmaceutical names. And the problems, of course, are huge in traditional Chinese medicine, where many tens of different kinds of plant species are being used, often in different combinations. And suffice it to say, if one makes it an error in those plant identifications, and there are some very well-documented examples, you can end up doing much more harm than good. One of the activities at Kew, the so-called Nightshade collaboration, was a collaboration between Kew and Guy's and St. Thomas's Hospital to provide toxological, botanical, and mycological expertise to aid in the identification of poisonous plants. And at Kew, we also did a certain amount of identification in forensic work, particularly in this case of the torso in the Thames, in which the stomach context contained plant material identified as the calabar bean. And this information, along with DNA and bone chemistry analysis, were used to identify the boy's origin as in Nigeria. Another area where identification of fragmentary plant material is important is in archaeological or paleontological contexts. One of the great strengths of the botany department at this university in the 50s and 60s was the development of vegetational history studies under the leadership of Harry Godwin and others, which led to an improved understanding of both the climatic and vegetational history of the last million years. That all depended on the correct identification of plant fragments, extrapolations to extant plant species, and from this to specific climatic and other kinds of environmental tolerances. There's no doubt that that method's robust and delivered important new insights, but there's nevertheless a legitimate scientific question as to the limits of this kind of uniformitarian approach to extrapolating species identity and their biological and ecological tolerances back in time. And sometimes we get surprises. For example, in the southern US, a species of spruce from just a few thousand years ago was originally identified as Picea glauca from its dispersed seed cones, but when the rest of the plant was assembled from other fragmentary remains, turns out actually to be an extinct species that had certain features unlike any living spruce. Further back in time, these kinds of problems become more severe, causing some to question whether even the most complete fossil evidence provides sufficient basis for the accurate recognition of long-term stasis of form and biology in classic living fossils, such as ginkgo. A recent development with potentially important implications for species identity has been the possibility of merging improved information technology with molecular biology to revolutionize species identification. A possibility that recalls the handheld tricorder of Star Trek that was used to scan and identify alien life forms, in this case, Dr. McCoy. The great attraction in creating so-called DNA barcode systems for species identification is that it could be automated and applied to any life history stage or fragment. It could overcome, for example, the practical difficulties of identifying tree seedlings in demographic studies of forest plots in the tropics. At this moment, that's all done based on gross morphology. At the same time, it could assist customs officers charged with controlling the flow of plants and plant products across national borders. Those of you who read The Economist will have seen a couple of weeks ago in The Economist an article in their science section dealing exactly with this technique and the tracking of various animal parts that are used in international trade as aphrodisiacs and other things. The barcoding approach has really gathered a lot of momentum over the last 5 years or so and has been applied most enthusiastically to animals. And for most animals, there appears to be sufficient variation in the mitochondrial gene COX-1 for routine species identification. For plants and for other kinds of organisms, it seems that no single gene is likely to be quite so useful. But even when you have a suitable gene, the question is, how many gene sequences do you need in the reference database? What should be the extent of sampling? How many individuals should be in the database? And what algorithms are you going to use for matching the unknowns against the living taxa? So there are a lot of complications and processes that will have to be overcome, and no doubt figuring those kinds of things out will rely on traditional expertise to a substantial extent, drawing on information that we've accumulated over the last several hundred years. It's not impossible, however, that for certain groups of plants, and animals, we'll have within the next decade a handheld DNA identification system. So to conclude, during the coming year, Linnaeus and the central importance of his contribution to biology that came from systematizing knowledge of the variety of life will receive considerable attention. Much less prominent will be the celebrations around another notable tercentenary, the birth of the French cosmologist, mathematician, and naturalist, Georges-Louis Leclerc, Comte de Buffon. Buffon and Linnaeus famously disagreed on many things, not least the basis for discovering the true order of nature. But in many other respects, their worldview was remarkably similar. And both attempted the comprehensive systematization of all life as it was then known. Linnaeus' efforts are contained in his Systema Naturae and Species Plantarum. Buffon's attempt was published in his massive synthesis Histoire naturelle générale et particulière, which ran to 44 volumes. Since Linnaeus and Buffon, the scale of the task that they set themselves has increased. But nevertheless, in recent years, their vision has reemerged with various calls to complete what they were among the first to attempt, a complete catalogue of life's diversity at the species level. For the most diverse groups of organisms, for example, the major groups of insects, such an effort may still be a bridge too far. It's self-evident that the fieldwork and the associated processing of the material gathered would be the rate-limiting step in any such undertaking. However, these kinds of calls to action frequently gloss over an important point. There's a big difference between cataloguing all the world's species and systematizing knowledge of all the world's known species. The former is open-ended and requires enormous effort in exploring and sampling the natural world. The latter, while daunting, is nevertheless more or less finite. It's mainly a task that involves bringing together and organizing a substantial amount of information that's very, very scattered, but that information that nevertheless already exists. Plants are an interesting challenge. On the one hand, they're a group of high diversity, at least compared to vertebrates, as you saw. But on the other hand, the number of plant systematists compared to the likely number of known plant species is relatively large. And the absolute number of species is a good deal less daunting than many groups of insects. And a lot's known about plant diversity already. So in this circumstance, where should be the right balance between gathering new information and finding new species versus bringing together what's known already? Given the rapid pace of environmental degradation in many of the most biologically species-rich parts of the world, it should be self-evident that now is not the time to stop collecting. There are many new species of plants to be described, and many of them should be expected to have valuable properties or to be of scientific importance. But there's nevertheless a strong case to be made for balancing targeted fieldwork with a more concerted effort to bring together, in the same way that Linnaeus and Buffon attempted, all of the existing information about all of the world's plant species, all of the world's described plant species. With the informatics tools now available, there's really no excuse for perpetuating an unsystematic approach to plant systematics. For both users of information on plant species and for those interested in developing a better scientific understanding of plant diversity, new efforts of synthesis are sorely needed. There are encouraging indications that this challenge is being taken up. Many organisations are making good progress towards systematising the key information that they hold. I just mentioned a couple: the Electronic Plant Information System of Kew, the Tropicos system of the Missouri Botanical Garden. And just last month, we completed a massive collaborative initiative between more than 50 institutions in Africa, Europe, and the United States that has made available over the web images of approximately, well, almost 250,000 specimens and the associated data on the approximately 60,000 plant species of Africa, beginning with the type specimens that form the basis for their names. This initiative, funded by the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation, went from inception to completion in a mere 5 years. And it shows you what can be achieved with focused, directed effort and the funding to support it. The ALUCA African Plants Initiative was launched in late February, as I said, at a meeting in Yaoundé, Cameroon. Darwin's view of species is perhaps even more applicable today than when he wrote it. No one definition has yet satisfied all naturalists, yet every naturalist knows vaguely what he means when he speaks of species. But Darwin also understood their practical importance. In 1881, in a letter to the executors of his will, Charles Darwin wrote of his wish to provide funds to Joseph Dalton Hooker, one of my predecessors as director of Kew, for, and I quote, "the formation of a perfect manuscript catalogue of all known plants." Through the Global Strategy for Plant Conservation, the world's governments have asked for the same thing. We should deliver that and more. The diverse efforts now underway in many different places are important and encouraging first steps, not just to provide a list, but a 21st century manifestation of what Linnaeus and Buffon had in mind 250 years ago. A meaningful summary of the identity of all the world's plant species so far discovered through a near-complete, widely accessible enumeration that also includes all that we know about them. Thank you very much.
Well, it's a very happy coincidence that we've been able to finish the series with a celebration of the 300th anniversary of Linnaeus and, new to me, of Buffon. And particularly happy that science shows that the species that they and their successors identified are not the results of the whims of collectors, but actually have solid identity as robust species. Sir Peter's given us a fascinating account of the science of identifying species in plants. And he's also stressed for us the importance of this, not just because the diversity of species is inherently interesting as the source of medical and other progress, but that the diversity of species is itself one of the great wonders of the world. It's very pleasant to have the chance to end the series by thanking Sir Peter for such a fascinating talk.